Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Inside Scoop Live. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm your host, Juanita Watson, and today my special guest is author Anna Murray. Anna has just published her memoir, Born on Friday the 13th. This is an incredible story of love, loss, and the happenstance of time and place. It is an inspirational story of survival and perseverance in the face of obstacles, big and small. It is an affirmation that we can all make the most of our lives, even if it looks like we've been dealt a bad hand. Really, this is quite a book, so let me tell you a little bit about Anna. Anna Murray was born and brought up in Kenya and South Africa and was orphaned by the time she was 15. She went to England to train in hotel management and catering, following in her mother's footsteps. Anna fell in love with the first man she met, had a child by him, who was born on Friday 13th, as she was, with the initial struggles to support her son and bring him up alone. Eventually, life seemed to be on an even keel. They were both happy until suddenly tragedy struck and Anthony, at 15, was killed in an accident. Anna wanted to give up living. She saw no reason to go on, but with perseverance and help from her friends and relatives, she eventually moved to France to start a new life. This was her healing period, and still with many ups and downs, she got through them and felt that nothing was as challenging as losing a child. Eventually, she saw happiness on the horizon and moved to America, where she has made a great life for herself and has stopped longing for all that she has lost. So, such an interesting story. Let's hear more. Welcome to the program, Anna.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. And really, congratulations on your book. This must have been an emotional book to write.
Yes, it was. And it started, actually, 23 years ago when Anthony was 15 and everything was going so well for us. And I decided that I ought to write about it, having had a pretty rough life, although a lovely childhood. You know, I seem to have lost so many of my family.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually started writing a book, which I called Against All Odds, because everything was so wonderful.
Welcome to Inside Scoop Live. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm your host, Juanita Watson, and today my special guest is author Anna Murray. Anna has just published her memoir, Born on Friday the 13th. This is an incredible story of love, loss, and the happenstance of time and place. It is an inspirational story of survival and perseverance in the face of obstacles, big and small. It is an affirmation that we can all make the most of our lives, even if it looks like we've been dealt a bad hand. Really, this is quite a book, so let me tell you a little bit about Anna. Anna Murray was born and brought up in Kenya and South Africa and was orphaned by the time she was 15. She went to England to train in hotel management and catering, following in her mother's footsteps. Anna fell in love with the first man she met, had a child by him, who was born on Friday 13th, as she was, with the initial struggles to support her son and bring him up alone. Eventually, life seemed to be on an even keel. They were both happy until suddenly tragedy struck and Anthony, at 15, was killed in an accident. Anna wanted to give up living. She saw no reason to go on, but with perseverance and help from her friends and relatives, she eventually moved to France to start a new life. This was her healing period, and still with many ups and downs, she got through them and felt that nothing was as challenging as losing a child. Eventually, she saw happiness on the horizon and moved to America, where she has made a great life for herself and has stopped longing for all that she has lost. So So such an interesting story. Let's hear more. Welcome to the program, Anna.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. And really, congratulations on your book. This must have been an emotional book to write.
Yes, it was. And it started, actually, 23 years ago when Anthony was 15 and everything was going so well for us. And I decided that I ought to write about it, having had a pretty rough life, although a lovely childhood. You know, I seem to have lost so many of my family.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually started writing a book, which I called Against All Odds, because everything was so wonderful. My son was in a very good school, and I had a lovely job, and could afford to send him to a private school. And then everything changed.
Well, I did not realize that you had been writing since way back then. I mean, I knew that you had started this book years ago, but I did not know it was at that point.
Yes, it was before he died.
Yeah.
Because everything, for some reason, I just thought life was too good. You know, everything was always against us.
Hmm.
And suddenly, everything was just wonderful. He was playing cricket for his school against and for his county.
Mm-hmm.
He was playing. He was doing well at school. He'd got a scholarship to Sandhurst, and I thought, you know, this is from the terrible beginnings of his life, which are in the book. You know, my luck couldn't be so good, and so I thought, I've got to write about this.
Mm-hmm.
I actually wrote it without using our names because I didn't want Anthony to see I was writing about these awful, terrible times that he was probably unaware of.
Oh, right.
So it actually started off, and it was all written by hand.
No computers.
No computers.
Yeah.
And so it was notes, you know, and I thought if he finds it lying around and starts and says, Mum, is this you? You know, I didn't want that. I was just writing, you know,
mm-hmm.
and used other people's names. So he wasn't aware of it if he did come across it, you know.
Isn't that interesting? So you actually, as a child, you grew up in a very idyllic home, and your experiences before your parents passed, I mean, were very extraordinary. Can you tell us a little bit about your childhood and your early beginnings back in Africa?
Yes. My brother and I, he was a year younger than me. Well, we were born in Malindi in Kenya, and for the first 3 years of our life, we had a nanny and an ayah, and she was marvelous. We loved her to death. And we spent our time swimming and walking on the beach and, you know, just having really a very pleasant time. Then my parents moved up to Tanganyika to a hotel. It was to run a hotel. It was during the Mau Mau, and it was pretty dangerous in Kenya at the time. And I think they were trying to get away from any dangers. I don't think they did, but, you know, because it was all virulent in the whole of East Africa.
It's an interesting environment to grow up in.
Yes.
With that kind of civil unrest. Mm-hmm.
Yes. I wasn't terribly aware of it at the time. I just remember as a child that there was this, the adults seemed to be talking about this giant, and everybody was afraid of this giant, and I didn't really know who the giant was. But later I found out that it was actually Kenyatta. And, you know, he was just a normal man, but
mm-hmm.
as a child, he was this person that everybody was afraid of because there was so much slaughter going on. And, you know, my mother used to read us stories about Jackson the Giant Killer and things like that, so I had this picture of this huge, big, ugly ogre, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, it was Kenyatta. And then my father became rather ill, and we moved up country to Nakuru, back to Kenya, where his sister and brother-in-law and family were, and he eventually died there when I was six.
Mm, you were six.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And then, so what happened with you and your mother and your brother?
Well, my mother decided to run a hotel up in Molo, which was up in the highlands, and on the other side of the Rift Valley, and that was just really very, very, it was lovely. It was a lovely childhood.
Mm.
And I used to ride to school and on my pony, and the syce would come, the syce is like a groom, would come with me and take my pony back home and then come pick, collect me in the evening, you know, at the end of the day.
Wow.
For a person like me, I was a little girl who was passionate about horses, you know, and I mean, I just had it all.
Oh.
And I felt so rich. I didn't realize actually how hard up we really were, but because I never felt it. You know, I felt we had everything.
Is that right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. We had everything. I mean, we never went on holiday. We didn't have television. We didn't have anything like that. But I didn't know about those sort of things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they weren't things that were in, you know, that anybody knew about. We just, mm-hmm. you know, life was just wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
It all seemed to be play.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just think about it. You know, every young girl's fantasy at some point, I think, is to have a pony or have a horse.
Yeah,
so,
that's right, and I had masses of them.
Oh.
I had lots of choices, and I could just have whichever one I wanted, you know. And also, the strange thing was that I was, you know, really brought up in hotels, because we had a hotel in Tanganyika and then in Kenya. And my one wish was to live in a normal house where I didn't have a menu brought to me for every meal.
Oh, that's funny.
And it was, yes, it was really odd, you know, but I did have a very luxury life, I felt, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And people love coming to, you know, my friends used to love coming to stay with me in the hotel.
Well, I was going to ask you if you had a lot of young friends with you.
Yes, I did. But, I mean, you know, this, I used to love going to stay with them, because it would be, you know, mum and dad round the table with the children. Whereas when they came to stay with me, we would go and eat, and my mother would be working, but the, you know, the waiters would take care of us, you know, and serve us meals, you know, and give us menus, and we could just choose whatever we wanted to eat, you know. So I was a little, I felt I was probably a little bit spoiled.
A little bit, if it sounds very luxurious. So now take us to where your mother passed. I mean, this, it's unbelievable that you had to deal with such loss at such a young age.
Well, in 62, Kenyatta was taken, let out of prison, because
mm-hmm.
He was caught in the early 50s and put in prison for 10 years. And then there was this talk about them taking over the country. And my mother wasn't sure what was going to happen, so she was a bit worried. And I was leaving school. I had just finished my primary school and just passed the exam there to go on to high school. And she didn't want to send me to the one in Kenya, because she knew she was going to be moving out of Kenya, because we were given the choice of keeping our British passport. If we wanted to keep a British passport, we had to get out of the country.
Oh, okay.
If we were prepared to stay in the country, we had to take up Kenya citizenship, and my mother didn't want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And she just wasn't sure what was going to happen to the country.
Mm. Was there a lot of British that left at that time?
Yeah, an awful lot. There were just a few that stayed, I had a cousin that stayed, and he really regrets it, because he took up Kenyan citizenship, and now he can't go anywhere without a visa.
Oh, wow.
He couldn't even come and visit me in France without a visa from England, because he had a Kenyan passport. And
And
I kept asking him, why didn't he change back to British? And he just told me this last year that he had to wait till he was 60 so that he could get his pension from Kenya.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, so he wouldn't say anything before, but he's about to be 60, so he felt he could talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't know. I kept saying, why don't you, you know, his wife is my cousin, and she's got a British passport, you know, but
mm-hmm.
he always had this problem. But anyway, my mother put me, she then decided she had to get me down to South Africa. So she put me on a boat with a family that she had written to, who were traveling down. We hadn't met them, and but she was traveling down with her boys to South Africa. So she drove me down to Mombasa, and we met this family, and I was shunted off to South Africa. My mother stayed on in Kenya to sell up, and she had my brother with her, because he could still continue at the same school.
Mm.
And when she eventually came down to South Africa, having sold up everything in Kenya, she was obviously suffering from cancer then, but she didn't let us know.
Oh.
And actually, my half sister, who I was living with when I first went down there, had arranged for her to have to be used as a guinea pig at the hospital in Pietermaritzburg for cancer. Which is why she was drawn to South Africa, because I mean, we had no social security or health insurance or or anything anywhere in Kenya or South Africa.
And that's what led you down there.
Yes. And so she, I didn't know that she was ill for a very long time.
Well, how long did she suffer with cancer?
Well, I think she must have been diagnosed in Kenya in 62, and she died in 66. So, but she had biopsies, and then she had one breast removed, and then another. And even then, I wasn't prepared to admit that she had cancer and that she was going to die. I just, one of those things, you, unless somebody actually tells you, you hope it's not written true, you know.
Well, at that age, already having lost your father, I mean, that would just, I'm sure you couldn't even have, you know, thought about losing your mother as well.
I really couldn't, because I know that in Kenya, a cousin's wife, the children were the same age as I was, and their mother died in Kenya of cancer, and we just couldn't imagine anything worse than losing your mother. You know, it was just something so horrible that we couldn't imagine it, and I think I pretended it wasn't happening. And it was only when my uncle, just very close to the end, when my uncle came over from Canada and was obviously come over to try and help my mother out, sort out her affairs and everything, because there was only us, you know, children. And they arranged, we had boarders that whose parents were still in Kenya, but they went to school with me. And instead of being at the boarding school, they boarded with us and went in daily and then went back to Kenya on the holidays and things like that. And he arranged for them to go and live in the Young Women's Christian Association, you know, the club, and the men as well, the YMCA and the YWCA. And I was absolutely mad, and I went into the hospital and said to my mother, you know, Reg is getting rid of all our boarders. And she took herself out of the hospital and came out, and he grabbed me by the shoulder and he took me down to the bottom of the garden and he said, "Do you realize your mother has 10 months to live?" I mean, that really shattered me.
Oh, wow.
Well. You know, he didn't put it very well to me. And he was angry because I'd interfered, and I was angry because they'd interfered. And, you know, and then he put it so bluntly, you know, it was really quite shattering. I just thought, what are we going to do, you know? We're on our own, two kids, you know.
At that young age, jeez.
In fact, my sister and my half-sister and brother-in-law became our guardians, and so we continued our education in South Africa when my mother died.
So you were able to stay with family.
Yes, but it was quite difficult because my sister and brother-in-law couldn't have children, and they adopted two boys, and then they adopted a girl. And they were sort of like 4, 5, and 6 new kids that they had adopted who were, you know, obviously from not a very stable background before, so they were having to give them a lot of attention. And then they're dumped with two teenagers who were probably a bit stroppy.
And dealing with great loss.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it was, and this is a thing that, I don't know whether it's something that's inbred in us British, but you just don't show that.
Right. You keep your emotions inside.
You just don't show it.
Yeah.
I mean, when I lost my father, it's come out in the book, but nobody knew how I really felt.
Oh.
And when my mother died, I was, you know, nobody really knew. I mean, I was sent to another school because I had to go to the border. My sister couldn't cope with 5 of us all at once, you know, so we had to go as boarders, and they couldn't take me at the school I was at, so I had to go to another school. So I went to a brand new school 3 days after my mother died, after her funeral.
Wow.
I went to a brand new school, and I couldn't say, you know, my mother's just died and burst into tears. I just didn't say anything, because it was something that you didn't talk about that sort of thing.
That had to be very devastating not to be able to talk about it. And really,
yeah,
going from such a sort of protected environment growing up in your childhood, and then being just thrust into this trauma, and
yes,
and then on top not being able to talk with anybody about
yes
it. I mean, I'm surprised that you actually made it through all of that, really.
I know. And the strange thing is, you see, I think it was my mother that did this to us, because when my father died, she just, you know, she was always so bubbly and outgoing, and I never saw her cry.
Mm.
I never saw her miserable. She never talked about the devastation that she went through. And it's only as I become an adult and realize that, and I've got a letter here that she wrote to her mother in England, saying how absolutely devastated she was, you know. It was just after my father died. And I think, I didn't know that.
Mm.
You know, because she didn't say it. And she made us just, you know, go ahead and everything's fine, and, you know, we don't linger on these awful things, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why I was like that, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Do you think now, through the different experiences you've had in your life, are you more open to your emotions at this point?
Yeah.
I would imagine so, and probably the process of writing this book helped just bring all of that to the surface.
Yeah, it did. And I mean, a lot of it was really difficult to write. I mean, even the later on devastations were much more difficult to write.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a really good editor who kept pulling it out of me and saying, we need to hear. I said, I don't want to talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
You need to hear about it.
Well, I heard that your original drafts were, you know, there was a lot you left out in it. I didn't know it was your editor. I thought it was advice from friends that had read it that said, no,
it
come
was, on. Yes, there were. It was friends as well.
Uh-huh.
It was between friends and my editor, who, you know, one of my friends in England said, you know, you haven't mentioned such and such, and you haven't. And then my editor would say, you just mentioned so-and-so's name. Who and what are they?
Mm.
And I'd say, well, I don't really want to talk about that.
Yeah. That's funny.
And the thing is, she when I gave her my book, it was 33,000 words.
Mm-hmm.
At the end, it's 60,000.
Oh, you doubled it.
Yeah.
Wow.
It was really just, she was wonderful. Really, well, everybody was wonderful, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I've really enjoyed this year because I've put it together this year,
mm-hmm,
you know, and I sent out the original draft to friends to sort of say, what do you think? And, you know, Bella, my friend, she actually has contributed bits to the book, which, you know, I've noted. And, you know, her views of my mother, for instance, you know. And then she wrote a poem about Mwaniki, who was their African boy, who really was their nanny type. And every time I went and stayed there, you know, he'd run the bath and get in the bath. Bafu, bafu, you'd shout, you know, get in the bath. And then he'd give us our towels and get us out. And then he would have supper ready for us. And it was, we led such a different sort of life because we did have servants.
Yeah.
And he was just the most, we just loved him. Loved him.
Mm.
And she wrote this wonderful poem about him, which I've included in the book, you know. And
Have you been able to keep in contact with any of those people from your childhood?
Oh, yes. Oh, gosh, yes.
Bella, you have?
Bella. Oh, yes. Bella is very, I mean, I'm talking to her regularly. I mean, she is so excited about the book.
Oh,
she's
wow.
So excited. And she's got these five brothers, and I sent her a copy as a present, you know, and
mm-hmm.
bought another six for her brothers, you know, and because they're mentioned in the book as well. And Bron, I mean, she was a great critic, and I lived with her. When I first separated with Anthony, and she had her daughter Pippa, who was two, and I've got photographs of them in the book. You know, I've got 50 photographs, black and white, in the book. So sort of going through the ages, right from when my grandmother first went out to Kenya as Beryl Markham's governess in 1910, and you know, and I think it makes it quite interesting to be able to see the photos through the ages. You know,
definitely. Definitely.
And relate to what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Are you looking for new ways to promote your book? Why not consider being interviewed live? With the huge impact internet radio as well as podcasting is making in our society, your voice can now be heard worldwide. Let Juanita at Inside Scoop Live create the necessary steps for you. You will not only receive a web page of your own, but your interview will be available for MP3 download and RSS feed. As well, your interview will be posted on venues such as iTunes, Blog Talk Radio, Podcast Alley, and the Inside Scoop Live blog. Go to InsideScoopLive.com today for more information. Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Just to remind you, I'm talking today with Anna Murray. She is the author of Born on Friday the 13th, and you can find out more about Anna through her website, bornonfriday13th.net. Well, I want to hear more about Anthony and how you ended up in England.
Well, I went to, after my mother died, I finished my matric, they called it in South Africa, matriculation, and then went to England, but I was only 17. No, I was 16.
So young.
Very young, very, very young. And I went to England because I wanted to work. You know, I was a big girl now.
Of course.
On my own. And went to live with my aunt. And I was too young to do my hotel management and catering. They wouldn't take me till I was 17. So my aunt sent me to a private secretarial college to learn to type and shorthand and bookkeeping and that sort of thing, just to keep me quiet for a year. And I, you know, I vowed I was never going to work in an office. You know, that was not my scene.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I was very grateful in later life that I had that.
Mm-hmm, I bet.
But then I did my training, and at the end I met a man, Ted, and I think it was just insecurity. You know, I just latched on to the first one that came along, and we had a child, and you have to read the bit, that the next bit, but anyway, I ended up divorcing him, and... And then I...
And the details are in your book? Okay.
I find that difficult to talk about.
Okay.
It's difficult for me to even write it.
Oh,
but,
well.
And then I brought up Anthony on my own, but there was a lot... We had a lot of hiccups. First of all, Anthony was born. Ted wasn't there. He was born on Friday the 13th. I was living at my aunt's house, and she wasn't there. She arrived the next day. And she said, you can't bring him home. He was born on Friday the 13th. You'll have to have him adopted. And I just...
And this was your aunt?
My aunt. Yeah. Oh. And I just said, I'm bringing him home. She said, you can't. We had a big fight the day after Anthony was born.
Wow.
And I won. Mm. He came home with me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And she said, don't breastfeed him. I said, I'm breastfeeding him.
Oh, that's not what you want to have to be dealing with when you just have a baby.
No.
Oh, my gosh.
She said, don't start breastfeeding him. Do him on a bottle. I said, no. Nope.
She was very superstitious.
Oh, very, very superstitious.
Yeah.
She really was. And she said that no good would come of him being born on Friday the 13th. I said, well, I was born on Friday the 13th, and I'm the most wonderful person out.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a bit of a joke. But anyway... And then there was a lot of ghastly things that happened for me to keep Anthony. I at the age of six, I got I was injured, and I was on traction for 6 weeks in hospital. And I was working at a prep school, boys prep school, catering for 400 boys. And the teachers at the school were looking after Anthony while I was in hospital. And then my aunt came down and she said, I'll look after him. I'll look after him. I'll take him home and look after him until you get better. And then, which I trusted her to do, and you know, because I had no other relation. And then she suddenly said to me, after a month or so, she said, you're going to have Anthony adopted. He is 6 years old. Because I want to go to America.
Oh, my gosh.
I had nowhere to have him.
Really?
No. And I just said, I can't do that. And she said, well, you have to. I had nowhere. So I said, I'm not having him adopted. I said, I'll put him into foster care, but I'm not having him adopted. And so she said, well, you can put him into foster care with a view to adoption. I said, no. I said, he's my son.
No kidding.
So, anyway, I had a very big fight there. And then everybody, we got him into care. And eventually everybody persuaded me that it was the best thing for him.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, okay, eventually.
Yeah.
I said, you know, nobody's on my side. I'm on my own. You know, I've got nowhere to have him. Obviously, it's the best thing for this poor little boy. And I agreed to it. But then the family rang me up and said, look, we can't, you know. Since we've spoken to him and tried, you know, telling him that we're going to adopt him, he's just gone absolutely haywire.
He didn't want it.
He wet his bed. He's screaming. He's hiding in the playground. He won't go and play. And he was an outgoing boy, just like his mother.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And they said, we can't adopt a disturbed child like this. Well, he wasn't disturbed before they said that to him.
Yeah.
And so I went and collected him, and we lived in a car for six days because I had nowhere to have him stay. But I got him into another foster family. And then eventually, there's lots of other things, which are very difficult to talk about, but they are in the book. I eventually got him out of the foster care and got him into a private school. And it was hard, very hard paying for it, and it worked out really well, and all things changed, and he went from better to better.
Great.
And until 1985, when he got into public school, which is a private school, you know, like secondary school, but private.
Mm-hmm.
And in England, they call it public school. And he was doing really, really well there when he had this frightful accident. Working on the farm, he wanted to go skiing with his buddies at school, and I said, I can't afford that. I'm paying for your school uniform, your school fees. He said, but Mum, if I paid for the skiing and you paid for the pocket money for the skis and the ski lifts and the food and blah, blah, blah. I said, okay, we'll come to a deal. Because, you know, when you go on a skiing holiday, it's not just that the cost of that trip, it's all the extras.
Sure.
You know, make it double.
Yeah.
So I said, okay, we'll do a deal. And he said, and I'll work in the summer. So he was working on the farm. I was the cook housekeeper there. And they had a silo that was blocked, and he got up there with the manager, and the manager said, I need to unblock it. And he said, oh, I'll do it. You know, he was 6 foot, eager boy, and the farm manager said, okay. And he slipped, and the farm manager couldn't get him out.
Oh, my gosh.
And that was it, you know.
Now, how did that affect you? I mean, I can't imagine with the struggle that you went through to eventually have him, you know, with the foster care.
I didn't want to get out of bed.
I imagine.
I didn't want to wake up. And the doctor kept saying, I can give you sleeping pills. I said, listen, I don't even want to wake up. I said, I can sleep all day. I can sleep 24 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
What you probably need to do is give me something to wake me up.
Yeah, right.
I don't want to wake up.
I don't have a problem sleeping.
No, I don't want to wake
up.
All I want to do is sleep and hope that I don't wake up.
So what was it that made the difference in healing this loss of your son?
For 3 years I stayed with the family that I was with, you know, where the accident happened, because they were just a wonderful family.
Mm.
And I thought, I mean, Anthony said he was going, when he got married, he was going to live in the apartment next door.
Aww.
And I said, you are going to live as far away from your mother as possible when you get married. I said, you're not going to live next door to your mother. I mean, yeah, he had visions of us living there forever, and so did I.
Mm.
They, you know, it was just a wonderful, wonderful job. But at the next summer, I couldn't get through the harvest. I just said, I can't be here.
Mm.
You know, this is too many memories.
Yeah.
And so I took another job, and I took another job, and I took another job, and every job was awful, and I hated it, and I hated the people. I mean, I didn't hate the people, but I just hated the job. I hated having to get up in the morning to work.
Mm.
I hated life.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
I just felt that I was unemployable. And I suppose I was in a job that I didn't really mind. It was okay. I liked the people. It wasn't doing what I wanted to do. There was too much housework, and I told them, I said, you know, I'm a cook, and I don't do housework. And, oh, no, we'll get somebody to do the housework. I said, fine. And we made arrangements for that, and that was fine. I was going to stay there. And but in the meantime, before that, when I told them that I was looking for another job, my agent had arranged three super interviews for me. One was for Anthony Andrews, who was the actor in Brideshead Revisited. The other was for an earl that lived in Caen, and he's a friend of Prince Charles's.
Mm.
And the other was for Freddie Head, who was a jockey in France. And I decided, having told these people that I wasn't going to move, that I would, because I couldn't even go out the door. And at this stage, I had no social life. I didn't want to speak to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
I found it difficult to just even go out, other than just go to do my job and go back to my little house and forget the world began, you know.
Sounds like you needed a big change.
And so I decided to get me out, I would go for these interviews just for fun.
Okay.
Not because I wanted a job, but just for fun.
Yep.
So I went to Anthony Andrews, and it was fun to meet him and his wife, who is from the Simpson family in London, you know, the Simpsons.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to this Duke's or Earl's place in Caen, which was wonderful, but I wouldn't even get excited about. It wasn't what I wanted. And then I was flown to Paris. And there was this job that was just too good to be true.
Mm.
And they offered me a really good salary and a lovely place to live. And it was just beautiful, Shanti, just beautiful. And I came back, and they rang me up and said, you know, we'd like to offer you the job. And I rang my brother up, and he said, go. He said, I would have wished this on you 3 years ago to get
mm-hmm.
out of this country.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went. And that was really, I think, the beginning of my healing, because I had so many challenges I had to cope with. I had to speak a new language, and I was in a new country, totally alone.
Yeah.
I had to make an effort.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas in England, you know, there were people around, you know, always. And
it sounds like you basically had to claim your life back.
Yes, yes.
Interesting.
And I think and I actually am now going to, I have plans on writing a book on France.
Mm-hmm.
Because I touched on it in the book, but there's so much that happened there that, you know, was fun, exciting, terrible, good, you know.
So more like another memoir of just on France,
well,
or?
It will just be, it won't be really a memoir, it'll just be a story of France, because I was there for 13 years,
mm-hmm.
and people, last night somebody in the restaurant said to me, you know, oh, but have you got that in the book? And I said, no. They said, why not? I said, well, actually, you know, I think I'm going to write another book, because the next book will be more of my catering, you know, and probably start each chapter with a recipe and talk about the different extraordinary things that I did in France.
Really. What a great idea.
You know,
that's
so
a great idea.
I think that's what my next plan is.
So you will be writing more. So you are in the States now, and you're still working around food.
Yes, yes, yes. Oh, yes, I was a chef for 4 years where I'm working now, and I injured my shoulder. And my boss, it's an English restaurant, and my boss decided to make me the hostess in her English restaurant, which goes quite well because, you know, everybody else is American.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, great. I think it's great. So tell our audience today, through the struggles that you've had, how you can possibly maintain such a positive outlook and how you've kind of come full circle on your healing journey at this point. It seems like you have such a strength that it's like, where does that come from?
I probably my mother.
Mm.
But because of this, you don't dwell on bad things.
Mm.
You've got to go forward. And I think that was something that was sort of bred into me from a very young age. And I see other people just giving up and going to drugs or drink or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember even when the night that Anthony died, they told me, here, have a stiff drink.
Mm.
And take some pills to make you feel better. And I took the drink, and I vomited it straight up.
Mm.
I'm not, you know, I don't drink, and perhaps my life might have been easier if I could have just disappeared into another little world. I don't know.
Mm, I don't think so.
I don't know. And, I won't even take an aspirin.
Really?
No.
You're just face it head on.
You know, you should just take a little junior aspirin every day, just for your blood pressure.
That's so interesting.
But I don't know. I think probably, it was just instilled in us as children that you did not dwell on bad things,
just keep persevering.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, now I suppose for years I was looking for a man in my life, a family that I might have. I knew that I couldn't have my own children, but even if I adopted. And I suppose that's what I was looking for all through my life.
Mm.
And now I've got to this age now, 58, and I think, you know, actually, I don't want any of that.
It's funny how time does that.
Yeah, I would love to have had grandchildren. That was one of my biggest wishes. But I think, you know, actually, I'm just enjoying myself now.
Yeah, it sounds like you are.
And and now I've got this idea of this other book, this next book, which I think will probably be much more on, as I said, food and what I did in France, because that was probably the biggest healing period of my life, you know, in France.
I can't wait to see that book. So you're writing it right now?
Well, yeah, I'm starting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you're really starting a new chapter of your life with your whole writing career.
Well, and the thing is that if you read the book, I've had terrible, terrible accidents where I'm working here in America.
Mm.
And I'm a rider, you know, I've ridden horses since I was sort of three,
mm-hmm.
And there's no way I could ride a horse now because of the accident I've had at work. And I'm not physically fit to do the things that I used to do when I was younger, playing tennis and squash and riding, and that sort of thing. I can't do this now. I've got a shoulder that's pretty useless, and a leg that I ripped up, and
jeez,
on a high chair.
Oh God!
Yes, it was terrible, terrible. And so I need another. And this is what I did in France. You see, I played bridge a lot in France, in England, and I had. I rode and I did all sorts of other things, and then when I moved to France, I couldn't play bridge because I didn't feel I could play bridge in French, and so I didn't play bridge for 13 years, and I really felt deprived.
Mm-hmm.
But I found something else to interest me, you know, and because I hadn't got what I was used to, I then found something else that took the place. And it's the same when I moved to the States, as I haven't got the hunting that I got really involved with the hunting in France, you know, stag hunting. I moved here and I did go hunting, fox hunting a couple of times, but it's not the same thing.
Mm.
And I didn't really enjoy it that much, you know. And and all the things that I used to do in France, I don't do now, but I do all sorts of other things. And now this writing is perhaps another thing, because I really... The writing was very sporadic over the years that from when I started.
It sounds like
after Anthony died, I changed it. It was called Against All Odds.
Yes.
Because I felt that, you know, life was too good.
Yeah.
It was just incredible. And then when everything went bad, I eventually changed it to Born on Friday the 13th. And not for any... superstitious reasons, really. It's just that three big events happened on the 13th. You know, I was born, he was born, and he died.
And he died, yeah. It's extraordinary.
And that's the only reason, really not with any superstitious things, except that it's left me just a little bit cautious about
the 13th.
But I can't say that I'm...
You stay at home?
No.
Not around any sharp objects or anything like that.
I don't really take any notice of it, but I just am wary of, I'm just careful.
Oh, Anna, wow, that's just so interesting. Your life is just so extraordinary. And I'm looking at our time here, and our time is coming up. You know, I think we could talk all afternoon just through your stories here. So I want to make sure that we get your website in. Could you tell our audience?
Yes, it is bornonfriday13.net.
Okay.
All in one word.
Okay, and your book can be purchased through your website?
Yes, it can.
And you have some book reviews and an interview up there. And
yes,
it must be said, I mean, you are getting incredibly good reviews for this book, and it's only been out a little over a month.
Yes, and if you look at the Amazon.com, I've got reviews on there that, you know, written by readers that have bought the book.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thrilled. You know, they're absolutely wonderful reviews.
Mhm. Well, your story and your life is so incredible, and you're such an inspiration to have gone through all of that and be sane like you are. I mean, and enjoying your life. It's incredible.
I often wonder why I'm alive. I really didn't want to be for some time.
Yes. So interesting. Well, I would love to have you back on the program when you come out with your second book. It sounds very interesting as well, and I know that we have so much more to talk about.
Well, thank you, Anita.
Okay, great.